podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live. It is Neil Atkinson coming up. We've got Callum Jacobs. Very much looking forward to that. It's a pleasure to have done Callum about his book, and there's more on that book coming out on the Anfield Wrap across next week. I had a very, very long chat with him about it, and I would recommend that as being worth listening to. Also coming up is our season reviews across the board. We've also got Harrier Pryor with a man who's running all the marathons that is to come too. But we will do our season reviews in the order of Mo Stewart first, me second, Neil Docking third, and then Mike Bancoli fourth. They are all joining me for this one. So you've got the inserts to come, but we're not going to mess around. We're going to include people's chat if we need to as we go through. But what I want is for you to discuss the season in your own way, any way you want. It's your call as to how you're going to go about it. We will go to Mo Stewart first. And Mo, the floor is indeed yours.
Thank you, Neil. It might surprise some people that I was so keen to jump in, but I have actually had some time away to think and digest how I feel about last season. So it probably does me some good to go first. I think about how last season ended in Paris. And yes, obviously, the game and the fallout afterwards was a bad ending. But there was a joyous, it was a build-up of joy right up until that point for most of the second half of the season. And this season ended with me basically on a flight to Chicago in the air, not watching the game and feeling quite happy about the fact that I wasn't watching the game and that Liverpool FC in its entirety was falling down my priority list for at least the next week or so. I mean, it ended up being 3 days, but that's by the by. But that kind of sums up how this season's gone in the whole. It's been a disappointing one, but this was the bad year that reminds you what the good years look like. That's the way I kind of feel about it, because you kind of need to have both to really fully appreciate one. And there will be lots of people now who said that they saw this coming. And to a certain extent, a lot of people did see it coming. But most of those are people who predict disaster at every turn. So the law of averages dictates they're going to be right sometime. But I feel like really going back and putting myself in that mindset where we were at the beginning of the season, there were a couple of big red herrings for me that kind of masked what we now saw. Klopp himself being so bullish with you, Neil, about what we did and didn't need. I think that really resonated with me at the time. That bloody Community Shield, where we absolutely handed Man City their ass and looked like, oh, wow, this is going to be the team. Nunes got his goal. Trent scored. All the things I was hoping for all happened. But then it all turned really, really quickly. I remember walking out of Palace at home, first home game, two draws, first two games, chatting to Robbo. And it was all about the brilliance of Diaz and the struggles of Nunes. And I remember kind of saying to him, well, hopefully we're only talking about one of these by the end of the season. And we were, but it was the wrong one. And again, that is a kind of a microcosm of the way the season went. There was optimism, there was hope, but it was quickly dashed by reality. And it was a lot of things that we had to deal with, that a lot of other teams had to deal with, that we didn't deal with anywhere near as well for a multitude of reasons. I think the World Cup being the biggest, most obvious one, I just, again, tried to put myself in the mindset of where we were going into that. We were desperate for that World Cup break to save us. So that was going to be what changed the season around. And it made it worse. It made it actually worse. And I remember that feeling of despair of thinking, shit, maybe they aren't coming back. Maybe this is the end. And yes, to a certain extent, they did come back. And they went from being unserious and unreliable to once again looking like the team that we know and love. And you can say that maybe that makes it harder, the fact that in the end we made it so close, and maybe it would hurt less if we'd have just ended up like Spurs, completely rudderless. But I don't buy that. I wanted to see that we were there, and I think it's important for the road back that we see that we were there. It's a lot easier from here than it is from where Tottenham are. But it does sting that we were that close, that if you look at it, even after everything, we beat Villa and we hand Southampton their ass and we're there. Like, we literally still could be there. We were only 4 points behind Newcastle at the end of the final shake. So you think, could we have got ourselves together quicker? Like, I wonder what happens in a world where Gareth Southgate doesn't pick Trent and Klopp has him, Andy Robertson, Bicetic and Joe Gomez, the whole break to work on this new thing that we ended up with. I wonder what happens in that scenario. We'll never know. But I do think there are lots of people who will need to assess how they went about things this season, coaching staff, management, and players, and hope to do things differently. But there is optimism that that can happen, I think. I've ended with probably more optimism than I'd had at any point since that very beginning.
Okay. So what is your primary driver for the optimism, Mo? Is it just the way in which the results have gone in the end, or is it that you want to be optimistic? What is the primary driver?
I mean, you know that naturally I always am optimistic. I do try to find joy in life. I do think it's important to believe that's kind of what we're in it for. But there is some hard evidence to that. I do think, obviously, this new system does seem to have been the driver for our change in fortunes towards the end of the season. And there is potential from the platform we've given to build on it through the transfer market, through another preseason of bedding in these tactics. So there is a road to an evolution of the team that can see us return. I do think as well that there is scope for improvement within the players we've already got. It's not all going to be just players coming in. But I do think one of our best things in the history of the Klopp era is being able to know when we fucked it up. And I think the fact that we're bringing in someone new to deal with the transfers tells me that we're in a situation where we know what has gone before can't continue for whatever reason. And I think that we have the ability to look within ourselves and find a new way.
Okay. Anyone else on anything that Mo said there? Neil, Mike? Go on, Mike.
Just on your point on optimism, and I know you, Mo, you're an optimistic guy in general. So it's been a tough season for all of us, but are there any spells in the season, apart from maybe the back end of it, that you can look back on and think of in any way positively? Like, are there any things or any players' performances that you look back on this season and think, okay, there's something that we can actually really build on for next season?
The biggest one for me is Cody Gakpo. I think Cody Gakpo, not only the manner of the signing, how it came from nowhere, and the fact that it was one of those where lots of us didn't really quite see the logic, and then it turned out to be they had a different plan for him all along, and lo and behold, that plan seems to have worked. That part of the Liverpool ethos is still alive and kicking, and I think that was a really important part of our first resurgence, and if we still have the ability to do that, then we're going to need it.
At one stage, Mo, it looked like we weren't going to get European football at all. And yeah. I hosted a show. We had a good old ding-dong with Kev Walsh about whether or not we want to be in Europe. Are you still of the view now that we've qualified for Europa League that that's something, again, to be optimistic about?
Definitely, I do. I think that the way that our squad will probably be situated in terms of having new players to come in and bed in and younger players or players who have still got some improvements to make, having games that are maybe not quite as much of a tightrope. So Champions League game, I think you have to always be at as close to 100% intensity as you can, even for some of the smaller teams. I think you can maybe drop that about 10-15%, maybe even 20-30%, depending on who we draw in the Europa League. And just that extra bit of space to be able to get yourselves together, to be able to bed into what needs to be done, I think will be quite vital. I do think as well we're going to still need to have a big squad to kind of mitigate some of the injury issues that I don't see going away just with the click of a finger. We've been unlucky, but we can't say that we're just not going to have any injuries, because that is the exception rather than the rule. So we're going to need a bigger squad, and ergo, you're going to need games to give those squad. And I think having European games is going to be important. I buy that there might be some issues with the timetable, particularly if we end up having to play a team in Kazakhstan at like 3 p.m. on a Thursday. But I do think overall the good outweighs the bad.
Okay. All right, first and foremost, then I'll do mine and then we can go from there. I find the season a little bit difficult to talk about on the whole, because going all the way back to the first thing about it is that it just all comes far too quickly. Everything that happens after the back end of last season, the way in which it finishes, specifically with the events around Paris, just sort of leave me, when I try to sort of recollect everything, just in a little bit of a daze. It's actually been quite difficult planning what we're doing this June in the Anfield Wrap, because I cannot remember what we did last June other than talk about Paris. And I can't remember any of those major events. I can remember being in Glastonbury, and then from there, I feel as though basically Paris happened, did loads of media, woke up, did Glastonbury, woke up, and I was on stage in London on the 9th of July prior to the start of the season with Umo, and doing that event. And then from there, and I think Mike was in attendance as well, and then from there, going off onto pre-season. On the pre-season stuff, I thought they looked really sharp in the pre-season training that we saw, and obviously get whacked by Manchester United, but at that point it wasn't something to be concerned about. There was, I think that for me, that a lot of the conversation around the season is a conversation around the uses of optimism. So it's interesting that Mo ended sort of talking about optimism. I sort of start talking about optimism, and I think that a lot of what this manager's done really well, you know, if we go from his very first press conference, he talks about turning doubters into believers. And he's very much used that power all the way through his tenure as Liverpool manager. And I think he is first and foremost an optimistic character, but I think he's also a character who wants to enjoy every moment, every last moment that is available, and wants that to be spread around as much as possible. And I think that that optimism has served Liverpool, I think, really, really well. There'll be some people who don't agree with that, who would feel as though if he was at times a little bit more grounded, not just in the season just gone, but maybe in three or four of the ones that have preceded it, Liverpool could have won more silverware. And I feel as though there's something else that actually happens during last season, which isn't just as simple as a conversation around where the players were physically or mentally. But I think that a lot of the optimism and that sort of enjoyment the manager talks about began to ebb away during the last campaign. I think it was eroded, even though Liverpool were going for all four trophies. I think it was being eroded by the behemoth that we have to go up against then. And that's something that I think I've only entirely understood through the run into this season, being exposed to it in a third-hand way through what's happened with Arsenal, going up against Manchester City and the way in which that goes. But I think that that has had an impact on the fan base, and that makes me really sad, first and foremost, because the purpose of this is to enjoy it. I say it is a leisure activity. I've said that before and I'll say it again. And it feels a little bit as though that those bits have been sort of lost. But then also, because it is the defeat of optimism throughout the very start of the season, arguably the run all the way through until the World Cup, because ultimately the players that the manager was being optimistic about, for a wide variety of different reasons, some of which are conventional injury or injury-prone footballers, others are the madness of whatever it is that's happened with Curtis Jones. Some of that is backing Harvey Elliott at a point where I think he should have backed him up with another footballer, but he very much didn't think that and optimistically backed Harvey, as he had done at the start of the previous season, it's worth pointing out. And I think in the long term of the campaign, that was possibly to Harvey's detriment, but hopefully not to the long term of his career. And then also the legs of whom he was asking to go one more round, one more season. The optimism that he had around that, I think, ebbed away. I think the margins are smaller than people give it credit for. I don't think Liverpool would have won the league by any stretch of the imagination or even challenged for it if Henderson's shot last minute against Fulham had hit the underside of the bar and gone over the line. But I think that Liverpool would then have had a different attitude and approach going into the game against Crystal Palace. Would have been more resilient then for the game that was coming up against Manchester United. As it is, by the time Liverpool come out the other side of that result against Napoli, which is the cancelled fixtures because of the death of the Queen as well. You know, Liverpool play that game against Napoli and don't play another league game until the 1st of October. I think that that optimism had sort of began to wane, and that Liverpool really felt genuinely very, very vulnerable in a number of ways, physically and mentally, and that was to sort of mark out the rest of the campaign. There's still odd splashes in there. That mad game at Arsenal, where, again, optimism is the problem. They concede the goal just before half-time because they've decided they're definitely going to score one. And everybody who's ever played for Liverpool goes and plays up front. You know, Phil Neal was up front somehow at that moment. And the manager post-match, in his comments, says, blames himself for that. He's on the sidelines and he blames himself, saying, yeah, because they thought they were going to score and I thought they were going to score. And that's, again, it's this idea of we back the most positive outcome. It's going to go our way. And then it emphatically doesn't, and they end up going 2-1 down in a half where they've been the better side for 44 minutes in the middle of the first goal and the Arsenal second goal. And they find themselves, you know, a reverse in that fixture, and they never really recover from the goal that they concede, you know, just before half-time. optimism like Virgil away at the City ground for Forest, choosing to nod it back across goal because there'll definitely be a Liverpool player there to tap it home rather than just nodding it past the goalkeeper at that point. Even though that would have been less percentage, it was still, he was still taking the optimistic course. You know, we'll be able to sort this out and go from there. And I think that that just sort of remains a little bit of a problem. Liverpool can't get the balance right all the way through the campaign. They go into modes of playing quite pessimistically, but they manage to make a complete mess of that as well. And then they think, all right, we've got to try and be a bit more front foot and we'll sort that out. And then there's like mad things where, you know, there's a lot of odd results all the way through the season for every team. But one of the oddest is this Liverpool team manages to get its act together to, for instance, not just sort of go to St. James's Park for a half five kickoff when it feels as though a defeat would have been the end of any Champions League hopes, but they go 2-0 up and get a lad sent off in 25 minutes. So, of course, you sort of believe in this because you keep getting reasons to believe. And everything the manager's ever done has been like, so we build on that belief. And then the next game after that, they play Real Madrid at home and they go 2-0 up. And then it's the ultimate death of optimism because they then concede 5 goals in about 35 minutes, one of which is just an absolute gift from the goalkeeper. So then they go to Palace and they play like absolute misery gutters when there was a game there to be won because they can't quite get the balance right. And then 2 games later, they put 7 past Manchester United. And then they go to Bournemouth and act like they're going to obviously absolutely whack them and dominate them for 20 minutes. And then one thing goes wrong and they go, oh God, we're all rubbish. And all the way through the season, I think because so much of this is built on optimism and on this idea of this enjoyment, and it's not like it ever gets to the point where you need to be genuinely, unbelievably miserable. So in between the results against Nottingham Forest and Leeds, which I think are the two worst results of the season and the two defining results of the season, they go to Ajax and win 3-0. They go to Ajax and win 3-0, and then they bounce back off to the Leeds defeat and beat Napoli, who'd smashed them before 2-0, and then they go to Tottenham and win 2-1. So because there's never actually, there's worse runs under Klopp. There have been worse runs under Klopp than any run that there is at any given time this season. There's been worse runs of Liverpool sides you've seen in the past, by some distance, than any point you've seen this season. But they never become truly abject in a way which says we've got to save the day until possibly they have to gird the loins because they're 2-0 down at home to Arsenal. And then that gets them going with a new thing. And ultimately, my answer to this is that I don't want the optimism to stop. And in fact, if anything, I want it to come back. I don't want the enjoyment to stop. I want the enjoyment to come back. I think a season where for the first 10 games, Manchester City's results are none of our business is the most important thing we can do next season. You know, we've got to kick off and not even think about what Manchester City are doing because we only play them twice. So we've just got to do our thing. And there's 36 other games that we can have a real confidence we can win. But we don't have to kick off like we're 1-0 down, which is part of what the optimism led to, because we felt we could go toe-to-toe with this behemoth. We kick off 1-0 down. So that's my one. I need that to stop. And I think we've got to get back to the sheer joyous enjoyment of it. And that's what I think we do after, during the Arsenal game, and then in that run-in, even including the madness of what happens at Southampton. I think we need to have a bit of that across the next, certainly across the first start, the start of next season, and go from there. Has anyone got any questions? I went longer than I told you all to go. Sorry.
A lot of what you've talked about there speaks to me about the mindset and the mentality not being right, you know, from one week to the next. And also you talked about, you know, the issues. I've often thought about this. You know, we go to Fulham, nearly could have won on the opening day. But teams have a mixed bag of an opening day. That's not an uncommon occurrence. Then, you know, a red card and we struggle with a draw against Palace. But it felt after two games already so desperate. And for such an experienced group of players and, with you know, and leaders as well, managers, coaching staff, why do you think that everything...
Manchester City.
Yeah. Is that purely it? That they just made everything feel so desperate so quickly?
I think they dropped points in the first two games and they went, well, we're not going to win the league with this lot. And I think there is a problem. And I've heard this said in the past about other players, you know, going back sort of 10, 15 years. Like, for instance, Gerrard is better in the 08-09 season and arguably the 13-14 season than seasons where Liverpool are just going for fourth. Because if you've been there, you can raise yourself to want to be there, or if it's something you've not done before. But if it just becomes a bit of a trudge, and I think ultimately they need to, that, you know, if I have got a criticism of all of them, and I do include the manager, and I don't think the manager had a good season at all. I don't think he's had a good season at all. I think he's got a lot wrong. And I think in that context, I think he's sort of got it game by game wrong. I think he's not entirely got to grips with what he's doing with the five subs at times. I think there's been other bits and pieces through the campaign. I think he's began to sort of second guess himself and misread the moment. But I ultimately think, because they know they're going up against Manchester City, it's not just the idea of not winning in the first two. It's the idea that Fulham away and Palace at home are exactly the sort of games you need to be winning if you're going to win this league. And I think they just do their own heads in, and then they go to United in the crap, and they're actually all right second half at United. They almost get their act together again in this sort of weird thing that they keep going through. But they're still awful until they go 2-0 down. And then they sort of right themselves a little bit. And I just think they've had their heads burnt out. And that's what I think of one moment.
The other thing you got to put into the mix of that is Haaland, because he instantly changed who they were. And for all of the outside noise of people saying, oh, well, maybe he's not going to make them as good. Players know players. They know how good he was.
Yeah.
They
knew
he was going to be better. They played against him.
I think there's that, but I think there's something else in that as well, Mo, and this isn't a criticism of Nunez, and I think Nunez will be better than fine for Liverpool next season. But I think that one of the things they then looked around their own dressing room and went, Christ, I wish we had a couple of new boys.
Exactly.
That aspect of that, as much as anything else, I think sort of does them in as well.
Definitely.
Here's a question, Neil, on a City point, because we're obviously recording this before they play United in the Cup final and obviously before they play Inter Milan in the Champions League final. And there's every chance they win the treble, right?
Yeah.
And that's only going to add to their aura as a side. So they are already a side that won 5 league titles in 6. They are the side to be. Everyone knows this now. How do you think that affects us as a camp? Is it as simple as us adding some, you add a Thuram, a Kone, all these fresh players, and we get this new lease of life and we are able to enjoy it again? Or does City win the treble actually add more pressure? It's like, oh my gosh, these guys are just unstoppable.
No, I don't think it adds more pressure, because I think the pressure couldn't be any greater, because it's all about one thing, which is going and winning the league. I think that the freshness of new footballers around, who, by the way, haven't lived 5-6 years of this, is no bad thing. And that they bounce in and they're almost a bit like, yeah, that's sound, we know about that, but we'll sort that out in time. That can't run forever, because nothing goes forever in football. So I think an element of that's no bad thing. But I think also the pressure cannot be any greater. And I think in a sense, the idea of coming from 5th to make a run of the whole thing, then I think I think that the idea of I can't wait for the fixtures to come out, not least because there's a really nice opening run that Liverpool could maybe sort of do with having. And it's not the obvious things, like, for instance, there's nothing wrong with them having Tottenham away first 3 games and stuff, going somewhere that's meant to be theoretically tough, but going and getting something out of it and feeling like a bit of cohesion and togetherness. So yeah, that's my sort of thing on that. I don't think the City, and also if City do the treble, there's almost a part of everyone, which is almost a bit like, well, that's out the way now. That's done. You know what I mean? This thing that you've got in your head. If they just do it, then it's done. And then that's what we're up against. And now everyone knows what we're up against. And I think almost also the shared thing with Arsenal and everyone talking about all the bits and pieces of it all, I think it helps us, and I think it takes the pressure off. Anything else? Okay. This is Tour Live. We will go over now for our inserts, as discussed earlier on. Callum and JP talking to Harriet. JP with Harriet first, and Callum with me talking about his book, A New Formation. That is part one of Tour Live. Immediately at the start of part two will be Neil Docking.
And I am now delighted to be joined by Josh Patterson, just a couple of weeks after he became the first man to run 76 marathons in 76 cities across the UK in 76 days. First of all, how are you? It must have been some pain after you finished all of that.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I mean, I started this challenge with one person showing up to Inverness, and then we finished it at Buckingham Palace with hundreds. Like, it was just, if I could bottle that feeling up and have that for the rest of my life, I think it's just testament to the challenge. And I think the impact that it's just had around all four nations, it was just unbelievably special.
So I've just given a bit of an insight, but in your own words, give a bit of an introduction to what you've been spending the last few months of your life doing.
Yeah, so I basically have, as you've pretty much explained it, I wanted to basically do a challenge that was going to benefit the entirety of the UK, all four nations. And I started looking at charities and Samaritans. You know, mental health is a huge passion of mine. And Samaritans for me were a great charity right now for a lot of people who are struggling. You know, when they're trying to reach out for that support, more often than not, the support is just not there in place, or there's a huge wait time. So Samaritans are simple. You can pick up the phone as many times as you like, for as long as you like, and there will be a person at the end of it who can support you through your problems. Now, they're not trained therapists, but they're there to have that conversation. And for me, that's a great starting point and solution. And when I looked at the hubs that they had one in all 76 cities around the UK. And so for me, it was just like an absolute no-brainer. So for every penny that we raised, it would benefit everyone. Certainly from a physical point, I've done some crazy things in the past, but this by far has been like the longest I've ever done.
Yeah, I mean, let's backtrack a little bit to the start, because you mentioned there you chose the charity and you wanted to do something for Samaritans. But how did you come up with the idea of running the marathon in every city? And surely a lot of people were looking at you saying, really? Are you really able to do that? Are you going to do that?
Yeah, I mean, but that's the exciting thing, right? When you come up with an idea, you want that shock factor. Like when you tell somebody that you're going to run a marathon in all 76 UK cities, if their jaw doesn't drop and they think you're crazy, like you need it. Like, because otherwise, if it's like, oh, okay, then there's no point doing it. The shock factor is what makes it exciting. It's the disbelief that it is possible. You know, it's proving people wrong in a good way. And actually just showcasing what we're capable of achieving. And as I said, you know, for me, it wasn't just a random number of 76 cities. Ultimately, Samaritans, a charity I was raising money for, had a hub in every single one of those cities. So, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, for the first time when raising money and awareness for a charity, I wanted it to benefit everyone, not just one single place.
Yeah, you had that real link between what you were doing and the challenge and the charity you were raising money for. Talk us through what training was like, both in a physical and mental sense, because a lot of the work you're doing is around mental health. So what was it like in a mental way, really overcoming these challenges when you're preparing to get started?
Yeah, great question. I mean, this is an interesting thing, right? People always ask you, like, is this challenge more mental or is it more physical? Physically, you obviously have to prepare your body to take on a challenge of this magnitude, but mentally, you have to be able to tolerate pain and to push further when you think it's just not possible. And it's inevitable. You know, it's one of those things where, in all honesty, it doesn't really matter how much you prepare. You could go into something physically the best shape of your life and then sustain an injury on day one. It could be a complete freak thing. For me, it was a case of like strength and conditioning, you know, going into the gym and just building the certain muscle groups to take the amount of impact that it was. From like a recovery point of view, just ensuring that when I started the challenge, I would be as injury and niggle free as possible. So I was dedicating like 5 hours a week to soft tissue therapy and to physio. And then from a running point, you know, I think people always imagine that you just have to run lots and lots of miles to get fit. It was one of those things where I had to build a tolerance to be able to run a single marathon. And then it was a case of the body just getting fitter progressively throughout the challenge as we consistently ran the marathons. And, you know, it was one of those things where, in all honesty, the marathon distance did not faze me at all. There was not one point in the marathon where I ever thought, oh, God, I'm really struggling with this. From a physical point, though, 100%. From a mental point, when I struggled, it would be more like fatigue or a bit of a come down after like an incredible day, which happened quite regularly, because to be honest with you, there were so many special days that we really appreciated.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when people are training or running a marathon, they talk about a certain point where they're like, okay, that was the hardest bit. For you, you've just done 76 of them. Was there a certain point or kind of day, was it halfway point where you felt like this was getting really tough now, or you remember it being particularly challenging?
I think from a physical point, in terms of the pain I was sustaining, it was quite early on. There was a city in Northern Ireland called Bangor, and I don't know what happened that day, but just things weren't going to plan. The kind of the terrain we were running on was quite hilly. And things like my Achilles had gone, my hamstring, glute, like my back had gone into spasm. So just pain was coming from like every direction. And this was like, you know, you're talking like the first 2 weeks within this challenge. And I just wasn't really sure. I think this was actually day 9 I was like this. And it's just one of those things where you're just not really sure how you're going to get through it, I'll be honest. But you just have to keep pushing. I think it's just one of those things where you just knew that pain was going to be inevitable. It was just a case of what solution you found to get on through it.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, but real high point for you must have been, as a Liverpool fan, being able to run in the city. And then talk us through the moment of surprise when you found out that you were able to run part of your marathon on the pitch.
So Liverpool for me was a city I was so excited to run in. You know, I've been a Liverpool fan my entire life. The club is just everything to me. My daughter, who's 5, you know, my photos of her wearing her first kit, you know, at 2 and 3 years of age. I was always that person who always was like, I'm not sure about like babies wearing football kits. I became that person. And it was, you know, Liverpool as a club for me is hugely sentimental because of the person that got me into supporting them in the first place, a woman called Betty Scouser. And I don't know, just the to be able to run around the stadium, which was a complete surprise for me. It just, it was a moment to kind of look up. She sadly passed away, and to kind of, even though she wasn't there physically, just in spirit, to share that moment with her. Like, crazy to think all those years later as a child, I'm sat there watching, you know, European nights with her. Fast forward, I'm now running around the stadium, and it's because of her. And just the people that came to join us that day, I didn't even know we were going to be running in the stadium. I just, for me personally, being in the city and then just running to Anfield was enough.
Yeah.
And the people that were running with me could just see like my face like lighting up, and I was like talking to them about the club and, you know, what it represents and how passionate the people are and how great the football team is. And we got there, and Chris Taylor, my right-hand guy, knew all along that they'd actually organized for me to be able to have this sort of like this opportunity to run around the pitch. And he kind of just blagged it that he was like, nah, this is crazy. Like, you know, I can't believe that they're not going to let you. I'm just going to go in and speak to the security, tell them what it is you're doing, which really embarrassed me. And yeah, next thing I know, they're like, surprise, you're going to be going in now. And just walking down that tunnel, it was actually super emotional. And I put my earphones in, I put You Never Walk Alone in, which I know to some might seem silly, but I don't know. It's like that song in itself for me just means so much. And obviously the messaging behind the challenge was to give a person a reason to live. And You Never Walk Alone for me, like, it's just the synergy between the two was just so strong. And it was just really special. I felt so grateful to experience that. And for me, that was hands down one of the biggest highlights of the challenge.
Well, I suppose You'll Never Walk Alone is really about never having to be on your own. And when you feel isolated, you kind of recognize that you've always got people around you. And that was one of the huge aims of your challenge. And one thing we speak about a lot of the Anfield Wrap is really reaching out to people when you are struggling and having that open door. And one thing you've mentioned loads throughout the time we've been speaking is the people that were with you and surrounding you and helped you through it. So just how important was that to have a team of people around you that grew and grew and grew that helped to get you through?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, when you look at the comparisons, right? When the football team is down or is not playing well, the whole song of You'll Never Walk Alone, it's there to lift their spirits, right? It's funny, when you're in a group of people, we feel comfortable doing that. But when we're on our own, we feel less inclined. Mm-hmm. And it's just how we reshift that mindset. And so for me, no one could question my masculinity and strength. I'm running 76 marathons in 76 days. I'm doing and going to achieve something that very few people that have ever walked this earth, and we're talking multiple billions of people, will have ever done. But for me, what was really important was showcasing the vulnerability, the highs and the lows, not being afraid to cry when you are in substantial amounts of pain, when your mind is playing games with you because you're not even yourself because of the fatigue that you're going through. And it being okay to lean on those around you, which I did, whether that be a complete stranger I've never met who's running with me for the day, or whether that be my team. But equally for my team to be able to read those signals of when I needed that support. And I think, in all honesty, that's what connected with the general public more than anything. It wasn't a case of you've got a guy that can just breeze 76 marathons. It's the fact that there's a guy here that in many, many different moments throughout the course of his challenge, the challenge has really broken him in some way, but it's that resilience and determination to overcome it, but overcome it with the people around them. And I just hope that that message will connect with as many men and women as possible. I think certainly from a male point of view, you know, if you look at what I think a lot of people's ideology of what a masculine man is, we had a lot of those come and join. Some wanted to talk, some not so much. Some like ex-Marines, prison guards, army, who have been through an awful lot. And this challenge connected with them in a way where they felt inclined to come and run with me and say how much that it had changed their life, that they feel now more compelled to share the lows with their partners or their children. And actually, it's improved their relationships, and it's also improved their welfare, which is great.
Yeah, and the huge thing for you was really opening up that conversation around mental health and making sure that was a key at the forefront of everything you do. I want to ask about the money that you're raising and continuing to raise, because it is continuing to pick up momentum, even though you have finished all the marathons now, and the what that will go towards in terms of Samaritans and the money you've raised, what that will actually do in reality.
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. So right now, we are on about 305,000. There's about 60,000 in gift aids. That's 365. I did a talk yesterday, which is another 10,000. My company's doing a mental health marathon. I don't know how much that could potentially raise. And the plan is to continue doing a few more talks. My goal to completely finish this off will be to raise 400,000, which 25,000 is really what we're trying to achieve to kind of cap this off. That sounds like a lot of money, but I actually believe when you've got a group of people behind you, that's more than achievable. How we're going to achieve it, I don't know. It's almost like a mini challenge in itself, but I think it's possible. And that money will go to Samaritan's charity. So it funds a simple life-saving phone call, costs £5. So when you think you've raised 400,000 and it's only £5 for a call, think how many calls we're going to fund there. And any person that I've met across this challenge, actually one story in particular I'll share with you, because I think for me, it just shows the value of it. I had a girl, Charlotte, come and join me in a city called Norwich, and her sister had sadly taken her life. She took up running to honor her sister. She ran a half marathon a week after her sister's death. And then with me 2 weeks later on, so 3 weeks after her sister's death, she ran the full marathon with no training. Like, that's how committed she was. And at the end of it, when I finished the marathon, I would have the flag of the country on my back to just show honor, respect to all those within it. And I gave her the flag to complete the marathon. And she did a speech and she said, "I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you to Samaritans for giving me 18 more months with my sister." So in some instances, it's not even a case of it can save your family. It's just giving you more time with that person. And like I said, I wish there was more solutions out there for the people who are struggling. But I think the world right now, there's just so much going on. So for me, Samaritans right now, as I said, is a service that anyone can access. And the branch that I visited in London, the longest phone call they've taken to support someone is 6 hours.
Wow.
So when you think you're funding a single phone call for £5 and a person is willing to be on the phone for 6 hours, in terms of value for money, and I think the impact that it can have on that individual is just unquestionable. So for me, it's a case of the more money we can raise, honestly, the more lives we can save. And I think that's the thing, is just breaking that down for people when they donate, so it just becomes more digestible. I think sometimes when people donate, it's kind of the trust of like, where actually is this money going and what is it actually going to achieve?
Yeah, and really people understanding what their money is going towards is the key thing. So if anyone listening that has been moved by what you're talking about and obviously incredibly impressed by what you've done, how can they donate?
So on my Instagram page, Joshua_Patterson_JP, there is literally a link in my bio. You can click on that and that'll take you straight to it. So you'll see donate here, or on Just Giving, the Run for 1 Million page, you can do that too. You know, for me, to be completely truthful, as a Liverpool fan, I've seen what Liverpool as a fan base and a club has achieved a time and time again when hurdles are put in place. And there was a part of me that felt like, with such a large fan base, if word was to spread and the, you know, the Liverpool supporters were to get behind this, in all honesty, it wouldn't really matter what the number was. I believe it's possible. If we can win a Champions League, we can fund the target. And so for me, as I said, like, if I can try and complete that final 25,000 in any way to anyone that can donate, even if it's just a pound, like, that just makes us a single pound closer to hitting that target.
Yeah, 100%. So that's where people can donate if they would like to. Obviously, we understand that it's a difficult time for everyone at the moment, both financially and in a wider sense, but any pound that you can donate is always appreciated. And finally, I want to ask you how you're doing and how you feel after the challenge, because so much of it has been around mental health. So how are you?
I feel good. Honestly, I feel so grateful that this challenge has connected to people on the scale that it has. I've been doing these challenges now for 6 years and I've never, ever had the reaction or support that I've had for this challenge before. It's just been monumental. And I'm just really excited for the future. I think that was the start of something incredibly special. I think just coming up with an idea is one thing, but how you execute it, in all honesty, is the most important thing. And I think the avenues we can go down now is unlimited, to be honest with you. You know, this particular challenge was very much focused on mental health. The next challenge might be different. It could be a different passion, whether that be, you know, the environment, for instance. But I just want people to know that had invested in this particular challenge, and for the next one, if you didn't feel confident enough to join me on that last one, just make sure you come to the next one, because the experience is just unforgettable. And for anyone that did come, the first thing they say was like, just, I'll be honest, like, I've been quite anxious about coming here, but they're so grateful that they came, because I think the type of person that I want around me and the community I'm trying to build is the most inclusive one you'll find.
Yeah, 100%. Well, you should be very, very proud of everyone that's done it with you, and obviously of yourself. Thank you so much, Josh, for joining us, and huge good luck with whatever comes next. Although I do think you should just take a little bit of a break first. You've just done 76 marathons. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Joined by Callum Jacobs, who's edited and contributed to extensively A New Formation, How Black Football Has Shaped the Modern Game. It is out now on paperback. It is available. It has essays about the following footballers: Justin Fashanu, Ian Wright, Andrew Cole, Hope Powell, Anita Asante, Danny Rose in there as well, and ends with Raheem Sterling. There's also bits and pieces on South London and the nature of South London, and a parallel history of black Muslim footballers all the way through. The obvious question to ask you, Callum, is the why. Why did you feel this was a book, an excellent book, I hasten to add, I've enjoyed it immensely, but why did you feel as though this was a book that you wanted to work on now?
I think, you know, predominantly, in my opinion, there's a lack of nuanced and culturally sensitive writing around these specific topics. And I wanted to also draw more distinct connections between the players and the communities that have shaped them and that they've emerged from. And also think it's important to say that although it's like it's a history of black British footballers, they're all of ours, you know, they belong to all of us. There's often a distinction made between, you know, black history and history when the two are interwoven and inextricable. And the more that you learn about it, the more that you see we're bound up, we're fused, you know, we're kind of one. And so that was the secondary part, I guess.
And what you mentioned there about feeling, you know, black history and history are obviously interrelated, but also within there, well, as one. But also what's also in there is, you mentioned there as well, for me, one of the things this evokes massively is a sense of place. All the way through, I feel all the essays have a geographic focus. It's a really present force, and I think it's something that is, firstly, it's very, very important, but it also gets overlooked. The extent to which places continually influence people, and that is clear in every single one of these essays. Is this something you were looking to draw out with all the contributors?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I've contributed in terms of relatability. So Moose Rokonga writes about Justin Fashanu because there's some convergence in their experiences. Moose is bisexual. Justin Fashanu, obviously, was the first openly gay footballer in the game. Nifio Ekpodom, who writes the chapter about footballers in South London, grew up in Lewisham and Orpington, and I grew up in Crystal Palace, so that was an essay that was informed by both of our experiences. But what I said to each author was, you know, be a cartographer, you know, I want you to map your experiences, and I want you to map history, and I want you to map place, and to situate the player or the topic within that context in a way that feels geographically specific, so that when you're reading it, you're almost transported around, you know, around a map. And each chapter is going to take you to a different place that feels prevalent, that feels important, and that feels integral, you know.
It feels as though within that, these experiences had by these black footballers, it feels to me as though the way in which they themselves have their lives moved is something that is a constant stress, almost in a couple of instances verges on trauma. You know, the number of clubs you mentioned there, Justin Fashanu ends up at, is, you know, it's either a constant trauma or it's telling of the trauma that he's repeatedly undergoing because he cannot settle, he cannot find, he feels as though he's repeatedly rejected as he moves all the way around. There's the background of Andrew Cole's life and his father's life in there as well. Andrew himself, you know, the story of the idea that he goes from Newcastle United to Manchester United and simply isn't told. Like, it's just imposed upon him.
It's startling, isn't it?
It is startling. To think that, you know, that's the sort of thing that you expect to hear of footballers in the 1960s. We've already got a club lined up for you. The idea that that happens, and it was the two biggest teams in the country at the time, well, the two sides of the top of the table at the time. The fact that that happens in that way, you know, repeatedly these things appear to happen to some of these footballers, and it does appear to really knock their sense of self, the sense of confidence, the way in which they feel.
Exactly that. I feel like players live itinerant lives, and I think that gets mislaid. But I suppose for a black player, it's twofold. You know, it speaks to a lack of agency. That is still the case today. Just for a more contemporary example, slightly unrelated to the book, but someone like Mikhailo Mudrik, who went to Chelsea instead of Arsenal, I don't think he had that much say in where he went. I think a deal was done and they said, look, you're going to go here because of the way it's been structured, whatever. So that still happens. But obviously, if you're a black player, and a lot of these players we're talking about, you know, they're playing in the 90s or the early 2000s, where you're not going to be understood as much. So you might find a home in a place, you might feel comfortable, and then you're... And that's specifically important to you because of your cultural experiences and what you need to feel safe. And then you're torn out of that and you're made to go to another place where that cultural understanding isn't there, you know? And I feel like that's, again, yeah, something I wanted to highlight. And that, yeah, as you said, it's particularly exemplified in the Andy Cole piece where he is basically a commodity, isn't he? You know?
Yeah.
And that obviously draws parallels with history. In terms of when people just didn't have agency and were kind of moved from place to place without.
But within that, as the essays explore and Andrew Cole, I think it is one of the most interesting essays within there. There is this little thing where I feel as though he himself is ready to reject and to move at all times because of the previous experiences that he's had. So he's consistently within there. There is the story of him storming out of Arsenal and they've managed to make some degree of peace, but he's always finished there. He knows it. George Graham's decided it. There's nothing that anyone can do. I feel as though there is, you know, within that, because there's something inbuilt within him, which is undoubtedly linked to his race and the way he sees himself within the game. He is just waiting to be rejected, and so therefore he is waiting to reject. And that's in there. It's absolutely ripped through the Andrew Cole chapter like rock. It's just there all the way through. But it's there in a couple of these other instances as well, as is detailed.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, again, you know, it's brilliant that you've highlighted that, because I think what I was trying to do as well was try to understand these people as humans and to make them relatable to all of us, because I think we can all identify with that in our lives. And with Andrew Cole, that's a hereditary trauma, almost, maybe from his parents as well. And that's just a layer of it, that a layer of these players' experiences that is always going to be missed, specifically by the media, through which the media is a very nebulous, huge term. I should be a bit more specific than that, but I think everyone understands what I mean.
Yeah.
It's oriented through that lens, and that gets missed. And I think that needs to be reapplied as a layer, and as a layer of context rather.
Within that, you know, you mentioned there the media, and it is, I'm literally, you know, myself, do the Anfield Rap. It's predominantly contributed to by white people, not entirely. It is also predominantly contributed to by men, not entirely. And, you know, we try to work to improve that whatever we can. But within that, there is another problem, which is that when these people who have a certain voice or want to sort of show that voice in the 80s, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, and we can extend all the way through to now, but in that time period in particular, the people who were acting as carriers for that story were almost exclusively white men. There was very, very little alternative to that. And I think that therefore being able to give those people decent agency and being able to tell their story is remarkably difficult in that period as well. We can come on to now, because this is about how it's changed the face of football to a degree, but then in particular, and Andrew Cole is another example of someone who really struggles with that.
Absolutely, and I think this book is only a really, and obviously we're talking about in a historical context, but this book is seeking to redress that in a sense, in a contemporary way, to push back against it. But back then, yeah, of course it would have been impossible, and it affected the perception. You know, we've spoken about Andy Cole a lot, and I suppose the reason for that is he's still... This is a Liverpool podcast, so obviously, you know, maybe not everyone's going to be...
You know, he's quite an enigmatic figure. Before you get onto all the other stuff, he's quite an enigmatic figure.
He is, and having spoken to him, he's also very introverted. And I don't know that he's massively likeable, but that shouldn't affect the way he's perceived as a player or a person. We don't have to fit into a cookie-cutter shape. And that's what I wanted to bring through with everybody, you know. the complexity of them and say, you know, you can know all of this stuff about them and not reject them. You'd understand them more. I'm not asking you to necessarily like them. You might end up doing so, and that's great. But you don't have to. You know, it's just, this is who they are. And that's what I'm trying to get at. And I suppose that does lend them some agency as well.
It is about how they shape the modern game and the way the modern game is now. You started off with Justin Fashanu and ended with Raheem Sterling. And there are a number of ways in which Raheem is different. We'll talk, you know, at greater length about him and this when we have a separate chat for subscribers in the next couple of weeks. It'll come out for people, but I'm not going to get you back to talk to you again in the next couple of weeks. We'll just do it straight afterwards. I'll pull the fourth wall down there for the listeners and just let them know that that's what we're going to do. But within that, it is about change, isn't it? And it is about the fact that things have changed. But I think within what I thought was really interesting within the different voices within the book is there are ultimately just different levels of optimism about the world as it is now, the journey and the trajectory that we're on. You know, Britain is in and of itself a really complicated and I'm sure at times genuinely quite dangerous or dangerous feeling place for a lot of people at the moment. I'm asking you really, you know, within the realm of Raheem Sterling, within the realm of Marcus Rashford, within the fact that Ian Wright has shifted himself into a national institution, do you feel grounds for optimism? Do you feel as though these footballers have shaped the modern game in a predominantly positive manner, or that the game has been shaped in part by them in a positive manner? Or do you feel as though there's massive cause for concern? Or is your answer actually, Neil, I think you'll find it's both, because I'm a grown-up human who can see things in a duality of ways?
Yeah, no, I think you've nailed it at the end. I think we can hold in one hand the idea that, of course, these players in advancing social causes that better the lives of people who look like them and obviously the communities that they're from, which I mentioned at the start, is excellent. You know, you see someone like Troy Deeney advocating for more Black history on the English curriculum, which, as we said, is all about history. So that's important for everyone. Yep. That's important to kind of foster understanding between all of our communities, from region and age and these intergenerational things. That's great. Marcus Rashford, what he's doing. Raheem Sterling's obviously now got a trust. A lot of players are realising the power that they have to shift societal norms. But we have to understand there's also a limit to that. But I think this country is in a very interesting place because, in a political sense, it's trending ever more rightwards. But I feel like, in a cultural sense, it's going the other way. And I think a lot of people are seeing through that and don't accept that as their reality. It's just not important. It's increasingly irrelevant. And we're finding it easier to live with difference, you know, or diversity is another way of putting it. We're finding it a lot. We're beginning to see that there are far greater similarities between us than there are differences. And so, you know, I think about this day to day. I flip back and forth on it. Some days I feel quite hopeless and that I really want to leave the country. And other times I feel immense pride when I see micro examples of that community. So yeah, I suppose it's not cut and dry, but I feel like things are trending, and I believe in a political sense as well, they'll trend back towards the left, hopefully. And so yeah, that definitely wasn't a clear or distinct answer. I suppose I feel the same way a lot of people do, you know. I definitely have hope because I have to, don't I, you know? We all do, so yeah.
We have to, we do. You should also have this book. It is excellent, A New Formation, How Black Football Has Shaped the Modern Game, edited by Callum Jacobs, and he has written an excellent introduction and a couple of very, very good chapters indeed within there. It is out now in paperback form on Penguin's publishing label and Random House as well. I'm sure it'll be available anywhere where you get your books. It will be available for you. Make sure you pick it up, and I'll be speaking to more for subscribers next week.
And we're back, and we've got Neil Docking. Neil, what is your season review?
Well, I think I'm bitterly disappointed, as is everyone, with the way the season's transpired. But I also feel very conflicted about how I feel about the set of players, the manager, and the group, really, because they're all legends. They've all won everything for us. They've achieved everything for us. They are players that I'll talk about in 20 years' time, 30 years' time. You know, the stories will always be told of this group of players. And I have immense sympathy for them on the one hand, going up against this juggernaut of Man City, this financial powerhouse with charges of 115 alleged financial breaches against them, with all their quality, all their resources, their great manager, just coming up short in the league and how damaging psychologically that must have been. And also in Paris, the events both on and off the pitch affecting the players and their families as they were affected. And, you know, a Courtois-inspired Madrid beat us on the day when I think we were the better side. Very hard to stomach. I've mentioned on previous shows the similarity with 14-15 and the hangover from not getting over the line the year before. A star player leaving, you know, Suarez then, Mane now. New players coming in who some would go on to be good players but haven't settled yet. And signings being made, signings that weren't made. So I have a lot of sympathy for them. The season starts with a couple of really frustrating draws, and I have I understand the view that their heads were just kettled straight away. They're not going to win the league. These are players who are used to winning, competing at the highest level, and they realise very quickly that the title is not going to be none of their business. Haaland scoring hat tricks every week, and we're struggling. So I have a lot of sympathy on that hand, but on the other hand, I still have a lot of anger. They infuriated me like very few Liverpool teams have. There were times where I hated the bones of all of them. Case in point, the third game away at Man United. You know, Erik ten Hag's reign has got off to a disastrous start. They've lost two games in a row, lost at home to Brighton, been spanked 4-0 away at Brentford. If we go there and beat them again, he's in a crisis three games into his Man United career. And instead, we gave him the platform. We gave him the launch pad for his reign by beating us at home. It was colossal for them. And we just didn't show up. You know, we weren't doing basic things. The captain not pulling someone down on the halfway line on the counter. Experienced players making just mind-numbing mistakes. And then time and time again, we'd have a performance that was more akin to what we're used to from this set of players. And then the following week, you wouldn't even recognize them. They weren't showing for each other. They weren't covering each other's backs. They were pointing the finger. It was like the blame game every week. But then again, there's so many injuries and it's a new way of playing. And because of City, we've had to adapt the way we play to try and achieve perfection, to try and achieve the impossible, rather than perhaps sticking with the tried and trusted formula that got us to the mountaintop. We're constantly seeking to evolve to play keep up with this juggernaut. So I keep on switching between, on the one hand, hating them, and on the other hand, saying, I understand, lads, it's not fair. We're all in this together and it's not fair. And that's just the way it's been, really. That's how it was all season. But there came a stage where I felt like we'd lost. I don't know if you lost me then. Sorry if I was still talking away. It came a stage then where I felt like we just lost our identity. I was just looking at us. I was thinking, I just don't understand. This is so far removed from a Klopp team. We're not pressing. We're not making life difficult for the opposition. We're letting them play through us. We're letting the opposition expose all of our weaknesses, all of our sort of tightrope that we walk, the high-risk strategy. We were making it worse for ourselves by not providing that cover. And I have to say, in the midst of all that, it goes back to the fury and being annoyed, incredibly annoyed at FSG, incredibly annoyed at Jürgen for not kicking up more of a fuss, for mistakes that have been made in the past being repeated. You know, we'd wasted one season. Our greatest manager of my time supporting Liverpool, we wasted the season after we won the league. We made catastrophic errors, in my opinion, not replacing Dejan Lovren, going into the season with not enough centre-halves and knowing that there was injury-prone players amongst them in Gomez and Matip. And this season, I'd called out long last season that I thought Gini should have been replaced. I didn't think we had enough control in midfield. We weren't able to have a quiet 10 minutes. We weren't able to absorb pressure like we had previously. And of course, the turn of the year, we just started winning every week and winning loads of trophies. And then we really nearly win the quadruple. So pretty soon I shut up moaning about not replacing Gini because it was making me look like an idiot. But the issue still remained. And when he was saying we had enough options in midfield, it was patently obvious we didn't. Even though Keita and Thiago had good seasons by their standards injury-wise, you know, with both an injuries just around the corner. We knew Fabinho had struggled towards the end of the year. We know Henderson's a year older. Milner's a year older. That squad needed freshening up. And again, Klopp was saying it didn't. The money wasn't there. It felt like money that should be there. You know, there's a big debate, obviously, to have about the way, you know, some decisions have been taken in terms of funding the developments of the stands and the training ground, the money that's not available for transfers. I feel like the manager needed backing in the summer and backing significantly to go again. He wasn't, and we've wasted another year under the greatest manager of my lifetime. And I find that incredibly frustrating. And that goes back to the point with the players. I'm sure the players come September, October, we're thinking, we've wasted a year when we're mean serious business. I'm sure Mo Salah is looking around thinking, I'm the business. These lads around me are the business. And we're nowhere near winning the trophies we should be in contention for. So the season, the reset of the World Cup obviously didn't come. Things got even worse after Christmas. You know, it just felt like we were just staring into an abyss when we were playing Wolves every week and losing every week. It felt on the road, shipping three goals here, there and everywhere. I just didn't even know what team I was watching. But then amongst that, I look back at some of the nights and some of the times I've had with some of the people on this podcast and with my friends and, you know, my dad going the match. I look at the Newcastle win, the last minute winner and the guttural release of that when they tried to, you know, cheat their way to victory of every trick in the book, wasting down the clock. And then the 97th minute winner. I think of one of the greatest days of my life being in that ground where we put seven past Manchester United, the famous Manchester United, come to Anfield and get taken to the cleaners like never before. Just standing next to my dad, looking at the scoreboard, just hugging him over and over, like, how good is this? That Gakpo goal, just replaying that Gakpo goal over and over on my phone on the train home through bleary, drunken eyes, just thinking, this is magic, this is Liverpool. And then we go and lose at Bournemouth. You know, so they've driven me mad like never before. Even in the Madrid, the madness of the Madrid tie, where for 20 minutes you think you're watching Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, and then, but again, we can't have a quiet 10. We can't see out any period. And the optimism of the wins, the runs at the end, we didn't deserve top four. We didn't get it, but we did put a lot right. I still have a lot of concerns about the new system, whether we're defensively solid enough to really hit the targets we want to next season. So much work needs doing. I look at the squad and most of the players, there's question marks of one kind or another against. It's a huge summer for the club, a huge summer. Mm. And I just really want us to see us go out, get the targets Jurgen wants, and just give this manager every opportunity to get us back in contention next season, because I believe he can. It just needs freshening up and we need to go into it collectively with the optimism that this is a blank canvas, a fresh start, a clean slate, whatever other metaphor you can think of.
Well, we can take any of them. In the comments, someone said, sympathy, why these guys lost to Brighton, Bournemouth, Wolves, Forest and Brentford with some diabolical performances. That those results and performances on the road were infuriating, Neil. But for me, anyway, the sympathy was just always still there, in part because of what they'd achieved before, but also in part because I just felt a little bit like, you know, in some of those games, one or two of them you look at after the fact and you think, well, they played quite well. Or one or two, like, for instance, Salah, who I think whose level I don't think becomes ever that bad over the course of the season. But he's the one who misses the penalty away at Bournemouth. A penalty you never thought he was going to score on the telly, if we're all honest. Any of us thought he was going to score. So I end up being sympathetic, if you see what I mean, because to not be would be to say that everything that they'd either achieved before or what they actually were as footballers was not quite there. How did you feel?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've won it all. They've been to the well for us time and time again. They've pushed themselves to the absolute limits. You know, two cup finals, domestic cup finals to extra time and penalties. Every possible game they could have played last season until the very last second, we had the chance of winning the lot. These are players who've played, you know, the ultra competitive, ultra pressing, you know, the graft they've put in for Klopp and his way of playing football over year after year after year. Some of these older players who've struggled, you know, your Fabinho and your Hendersons, they couldn't have more credit in the bank and they couldn't have more miles in their legs. And there was times where I was watching them and I could see them with, you know, not to pick on Harvey Elliott, but young players like Harvey Elliott, like Carvalho, being thrown into the midst at games like Forest. And I was thinking, these players, they shouldn't be relying on youngsters to do their running for them and to carry, you know, do the hard yards for them. There should be fresh blood alongside them. So a sympathy in that respect. And sympathy just because sometimes things just go wrong. Bajcetic comes in and plays really well, and then he gets a season-ending injury. You know, Luis Diaz doesn't look like a player to me who I ever thought was going to be injury-prone. He's an absolute warrior, but he gets a horrendous injury, and then the injury is worsened during the World Cup, and he's out for even longer. So much went wrong. The injury crisis at the start of the season, it's a long time ago now, but how many players were injured at the start of the year? Whatever could go wrong did go wrong. You've used the phrase often, they eroded themselves, they eroded each other. Were bad performances, they erode against, and then you get another bad performance and another, and you almost spiral, don't you? I have to say, I'm amazed that they pulled it out to the extent they did in the running and put together that run. I mean, it still shows there's still a lot they're burning in terms of their hunger, their desire, and, you know, the quality that's in the squad. You know, quality teams don't get some of the results we've posted. Sorry, terrible teams don't get some of the results we've posted this year. So that gives me optimism. And yeah, I do have sympathy for them. Mm. As much as I hated their guts, on many occasions. Don't get me wrong.
I was at Brighton, and my God, I've rarely hated a football team as well. Mo,
It's really strange the way you've kind of been flipping between it, because I've been thinking about that a lot as well. And for me, it's kind of like the difference between what is an excuse and what is a reason. And I think a lot of the time people get the two conflated, when the reality is that an excuse is not necessarily the same. Whereas a reason is literally why something happened. So if I dropped an egg on your head, the reason you got egg on your face is because I dropped it. But the excuse would be if I was to say, hey, duck, I'm about to drop an egg. And then I'll still drop the egg on your head. You'd be like, oh, well, maybe there's an excuse. You have an opportunity to get out of the way. And these things are very different. And that how I assess how I feel about the team kind of does change within those. So I think all of the injuries are a really good example. That is a reason. Like, there are reasons why, with better players available at certain times, certain results would have been different. I think we can say that now, looking across the course of the season. Obviously, that's the same for a lot of teams. So this is something that we dealt with worse than other people. And I do think that in terms of the sympathy for them, for what they're going through, and the human element of it in particular, when we think about the hangover from last season, that can't be discounted. I do have slightly less sympathy in terms of them thinking, oh, well, the season's gone too soon. I know it's a natural thing, but you need to be able to get over it. And I don't think they did. And
no.
Some of the malaise that we saw over the course of the season, particularly some of the disharmony that we saw, that I don't even really think in two seasons ago when we were in a bit of a malaise, I don't really think there was disharmony to that level. In terms of players getting each other and those kind of things. And some of the processes that we normally rely on to get us out of these trouble weren't working. And weren't working for long periods of time. And that was the part of the way I was a little bit less sympathetic. But the way I do it is, my sympathy is I have backed them to be able to put it right. That's kind of where the credit that they've got in the bank, that's kind of where it lies for me. Rather than absolving them from the problem, I think it's more giving them the opportunity to set it right.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said there. I have to say there were many occasions where I was very frustrated with some of our senior players and some of them not rising to the challenge. It's certainly Van Dijk, Henderson, Fabinho. I just think at times they were just nowhere near the level we've come to expect from them. And as our most experienced players and the leaders in the dressing room, I felt like we just didn't see enough from them. And I really think that they themselves, they can, you know, there's obviously issues around the squad and who hasn't come in and injuries, but I think they would look at themselves and I think they would honestly say, have they given a good account of themselves over the last season? And they'd say, no, they haven't. And they know they need to be better. So that's another factor. But then again, they've played 1,000 games, including a World Cup. And, they've put so much into their efforts over the last year. But I do think that with, you know, new signings and freshening up the squad, that we can go again.
Okay. Mike, it is your turn. Give us your review of the season.
Yeah, so I guess it's a tough one to analyse this season because it's just been so weird. It feels like the longest season ever. It feels like it's been going on for about 10 years, to be honest with you. You know, like you, Neil, it came too soon for me. You know, I wasn't in Paris, but I knew people who were in Paris, and I was like, I found it really tough after that, knowing what people went through, hearing all the stories, and the game almost became irrelevant afterwards and what happened in the game. Obviously, I was disappointed that we lost the Champions League final, and I felt like that team deserved another big one. But it was a real shame that, you know, what happened in Paris, and the season just comes a bit too quickly for me. So, yeah, I don't know. I just find it hard to analyse. But I think it's been a season where we both haven't made our luck. So I don't think we did enough to prepare for the type of season we wanted to have. But then we've also had hard lines. So I think in the summer, I was, you know, doing shows with you, and I said I wanted a midfielder in. And I really wanted a dynamic midfielder in that could, you know, had legs, that could cover ground, that could, you know, add some of the things we lost from Wijnaldum and other midfielders we lost in the past. And we didn't do that this summer, you know, last summer. We didn't do that. And the manager was actually really bullish about his options. I mean, he did the interview with you, Neil, where he says, what type of midfielder do I need? You know, he's very confident about the midfielders he has. So you're thinking, okay, you know, he's confident. I trust the manager. And ultimately, his confidence was misplaced because, you know, he banked on players that have, you know, injury records are questionable to say the least. You know, Keita, Chamberlain, And even when players were available, like Jones at times, he overlooked some of these players until it was almost too late. You know, the season was kind of gone. So it's a weird season to analyse. I think there have been so many false dawns this season as well. You know, there are so many times when you think they're almost going to do it. You know, they're almost going to go on that run you want them to go on to. So, you know, I think of after the Bournemouth game, the 9-0, and it was a weird game because you don't win 9-0 often, but it felt like one of those was like, okay, we really whacked the side, now let's go on a run. And it felt like one of those. And then after that, we had this another setback. And just so many times this season where you think they're going to recover and you think they're going to show signs of life, it just never kind of, you know, means anything. Up until the last, you know, 10 games of the season where we go on that big run and we have a good time, you know, I feel like that's the only part of the season where I really enjoyed myself. You know, I always thought top four was going to be beyond our reach in that spell, but I was having fun seeing this side show something new, you know, enjoy playing with each other. I guess the big concern for me this season has just been the lack of collective identity. And last season when I did my review, I focused on how much I loved being with everyone, not just the players, but, you know, the fans and going to games. I was there at Wembley for the cup final. That's one of the best days of my life, like genuinely just an incredible day that I look back on with such fondness. And there was this real sense last season of we're just all in this together. We're with this team. The fans are with each other together. We have the Jurgen Klopp song, you know, the Jota song, all of these things. Just, I always feel like when we have a good season, there are these songs that come out and everything just feels full of life. And this season, that collective identity, that belief, that joy that we always want to feel as Liverpool fans hasn't been there. You know, in terms of the players on the pitch, there's been a real identity crisis. I haven't known what to expect from Liverpool from week to week. You know, we haven't pressed well enough. We haven't, you know, at times attacked well enough. And it's just all felt disjointed and not really fun. And the players haven't looked like they've enjoyed playing with each other this season. So that's what I found really, really tough. But, you know, I want to end on an optimistic note because I do think there are signs of life. And I think while we have seen for most of the season, I would say for three quarters of the season, a team that hasn't looked like a Jurgen Klopp team, a team that hasn't enjoyed playing with one another, and a team that hasn't had a clear sense of identity, I do think that, you know, we said farewell to quite a few players who've been integral, Firmino, Milner, you know, Chamberlain at some points and Keita at some points. But I think we can also say hello to maybe a new kind of growing leadership group in the squad and you know, some players that I think are going to be really important for us moving forward. I think Trent's someone that has really, in terms of just his ability on the ball, but also some of the stuff he's doing off the pitch, I mean, the academy thing he's doing off the pitch, that's a remarkable intervention by a young footballer. And I do feel like while we're saying goodbye to some really important leaders, and you can say whatever you want about James Milner and the fact that he's been at the club for so long, and some people on Twitter especially had a real problem with that, but he was a leader. You look at what everyone says about him after he's left the club. He was a leader. But while I was saying goodbye to him, I think we are going to say hello to a new version of Trent Alexander-Arnold. Trent Alexander-Arnold will be 25 come the end of this year. And I think, you know, from this season on, the new season we're going to enter, he's going to be one of our leaders. He already is a leader, has been a leader for us for a number of years in terms of a technical leader on the pitch. But I think we're going to see a lot of the off-the-pitch stuff, a lot of the stuff we see from Henderson at times, we're going to see from him. And on the pitch, I think he'll become a more commanding figure. So I think there are reasons to be hopeful moving into next season. I think Cody Gakpo, it's gone under the radar a bit, really, but he scored 7 goals this season. You know, that's a fairly healthy return for a player who joined a very disjointed side, played out on the left, didn't look comfortable, then finally played in this false nine position, is looks really, really good. So we're looking at, you know, him potentially being a key figure next season, Trent becoming more of a leader. Someone like Robertson, I think, will become more of a leader. He'll enter that leadership group that we have. So I do feel optimistic about next season, and I feel optimistic about, you know, the players we're linked to. You know, McAllister looks like he'll be done at some point soon, and maybe Thuram and a few of the others that we're linked to. So I do feel a sense of optimism to end the season, but it's been the most un-Jurgen Klopp Liverpool season of our lives, and I hope this is the only one we have between now and 2026, because I just want to have fun, Neil. You know, winning the league's important, it is, but I want to have fun. I want to be doing post-match pods and tour lives where I'm, you know, just enjoying it. You know, this season, so many times I haven't had fun. I haven't, you know, wanted to talk about Liverpool. I wanted to talk about everything but Liverpool. And, you know, I just want to have fun next season. I do think that that's fundamental for us as Liverpool fans, you know, the journey. You know, people often scoff at the journey. We you know, the Champions League final 2018, where we didn't win the final, obviously, the journey was so much fun. And we can't forget that. We can't forget the days we had against Roma and City and those games. And I hope the next season, look, I want to win a lot next season. I'm very much on the quadruple train right now as we speak. But I want to have fun. I want to be on a journey next season where, you know, come April, come May, we're doing tour lives, we're doing podcasts where we're thinking about what we're going to do, how we're going to rest players to keep them fresh for these big games we have coming up. That's where I want to be next season. I just want to have fun. I really do believe that although we said farewell to some key players, although we've had this weird season where we haven't quite had an identity up until the last 10 games, I do feel hopeful that next season, with the signs we saw towards the back end of this season, we'll have a lot more fun.
Okay. Mo?
Yeah, I'm 100% on the fun train. And I do think this season, that's one of the main things I've lacked. And it's strange because I look at it from a personal perspective. Last season, I actually managed to make it to more games than I'd have ever done in a season in my life. And this season was probably one of the lowest totals I've had for about 10 years. And I don't know if it's we've been crap because I've not been there. Let me just say that. But it's kind of added to that feeling of kind of displacement and not unease with what I'm doing. And you're right, the fun hasn't been there. And even the moments that have been fun, like I wasn't at the Newcastle game. I was at the Bournemouth 9-0, which was kind of fun, but now I'm looking back on very differently. And it's almost like the fun of that moment has been ruined. You know, I wasn't at the Man United game as well. But what I do have from that is the memory that I will take with me forever is walking into the Anfield Rap office the day after, literally not saying anything, just looking at Craig and then just going, yeah, and just running up and giving him a hug and doing that to about six different people, like not even having to say anything, just giving them a hug. And that moment of joy, unbridled joy of like what football can do, that's the only time I really felt it all season. And I need more than one.
That, for me though, Mike, you've very much put that about us. I sort of see that in them. And I think that that's the sort of the key knock. And, you know, when it all goes badly wrong in the trenches, in those sort of the really weird middle months of the season. And what I mean by that is the middle months of the season are half of November, a slither of December, and all of January. They are the middle months of the season in the way in which in other seasons they are different. I think part of that sort of gives it the whole thing a bit of a lack of reality is that they just looked like they want to be anywhere but on the pitch. I mean, that's my big thing with Brighton away was I've seen Jurgen Klopp teams get beat. I've seen them get whacked. I don't think I've ever seen 90 minutes where, well, certainly 75 minutes until he makes some subs, where I've just thought nobody wants to be on this pitch. There's Fabinho's mad 10 minutes at Brighton away in the cup, where it looked like his teammates were looking at each other like, can we all just pretend he's not there? Because this is, we can't be dealing with this. I've got enough on my plate. And now there's this, like, I loved the Brighton supporters and some of the media afterwards were like, Liverpool got away with one there. Fabinho should have been sent off. And I was like, if he'd have been sent off, we'd have got a replay.
Yeah,
it would only have helped the cause. But seeing them in those moments is so 5-2 against Real Madrid, I'm sort of like, that makes sense to me, even though it's mad and it shouldn't happen. Because at least there's periods in that game, and especially at the start, where they look like, this is it, where Liverpool are playing football and we're enjoying every minute of it. There's so many games where I was watching them and they just look like they wanted to be anywhere else. And I think they've got to fix that as well. That's not just us, that's them too.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to maybe your point from earlier about just this, these new players bringing a new lease of life. And I think players like new players, good players joining them, you know, so I think they'll be energised by McAllister coming through and hopefully one or two of the French lads that we've been linked to coming through as well, because they understand their quality and they understand that they need help. You know, they need a new lease of life. And I think the club and the players understand where they are in terms of they said farewell to some of these key players like Milner, Firmino and Chamberlain. And there is a new Jurgen Klopp side that's going to be built over the summer. So I think that's going to help energise us. And I just hope that the players and us can go back to having fun, because that's ultimately what it's all about.
Okay, then. Thank you very much to Mo and to Mike. Neil had to make a move. He would like to be clear. He wasn't being rude. He will listen back to what Mike has said in his own time and go from there. Thanks to JP for speaking to Harriet and Callum for speaking to me. As I said, my interview with Callum that I've already done is going to be on Tour Player next week. This week, last 2 weeks on the Anfield Rap subscription service, there's been a phenomenal number of really, really good shows about Liverpool's transfers and transfer targets, and also in there as well, excellent stuff with Stephen Gerrard and Curtis on Curtis Jones, for example, Jamie Carragher and other people as well. It is a fantastic time to subscribe to the Anfield Wrap. You can see all of that stuff, fantastic stuff about Thuram and Kone, and there will be more of it as more players are linked across the next few days. It is going to be all go. We're doing our transfer committee shows as well at the moment. Mike's just been on one of them. There's another couple of them happening tomorrow. All the way through, loads and loads of bits and pieces coming out next week as well. Lots and lots of stuff about the summer, about the way in which it's going to go next. And maybe, just maybe, Mike will be right and the fun will most definitely return. That's been Tour Live. It's been a belter. Thanks for your comments. Sports Social Podcast Network.